Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker State Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I've got another Patrick McManus story. I decided to record another one before you guys got a chance to give me negative feedback on the first one, so you'll have to suffer through two. This one is actually dedicated to part-time hunter Wes Smith, my cameraman. If you are a diligent or regular follower of the podcast, you'll remember the podcast that he was on where he talked about capsizing his raft. Well, I'm sure he'll either get PTSD or he'll get a laugh. I'm not sure which one from this one, but we'll go ahead and dive right in. This one is also from A Fine and Pleasant Misery by Patrick McManus, called Shooting the Chicken Out and Arrows. My love of rafting started in grade school and lasted up until I was 30 years old, or, to be more exact, until about 15 seconds before my buddy Rich and I became the first persons to shoot the chicken out and arrows and live. A teacher by the name of Miss Goosehart got me started on rafting. I was about 10 at the time, with an academic record that would make a turnip look like an overachiever. One day, Mrs. Goosehart kept me in after school and told me she was going to make me literate if it killed her. I said, all right, I'd do it, if she promised not to tell my mother. What she wanted me to learn, I had no idea, but I was too smart to let on. Miss Goosehart, her eyes filling with tears, apparently gave up on the idea of forcing me into a life of crime, and instead thrust a book into my hands. Here, she said, read this as soon as you learn how. The book had pictures in it of this kid and a man floating a raft down a river. They had a little tent pitched on the raft and a fishing line trailing behind it in the water. You could tell from the look on their faces that the two of them were having themselves a fine time. I sounded out their names, Huck and Jim. Pretty soon, I was overwhelmed by curiosity and started sounding out the first sentence in the book. I sounded faster and faster. By the time I had sounded out the first chapter, I knew how to read. Old Miss Goosehart had hooked me on reading. It was a terrible thing to do to an innocent kid who wanted nothing more out of life than to fish and hunt and maybe run a trap line in the off-season. By the time I had finished reading The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, I had already had a raft of my own built. A kid by the name of Harold helped me build it, but I was the brains behind the project. Since there weren't many logs to be found lying around the banks of Sand Creek, we used old cedar fence posts. We tied the fence posts into bundles with rope and baling wire, and then lashed the bundles of fence posts to a couple of rotten planks. The raft was by no means as attractive as it might appear from this description, but I had little doubt that it would serve the purpose. The little doubt I did have moved to offer some words of advice to Harold, particularly since Sand Creek was at flood stage and doing its best to wash out bridges, roads, pump houses, and anything else that might offer it some amusement. I bet this raft would hold 10 people, I told Harold proudly. I bet it would hold 20 people, Harold said. You're probably right, I said, but when we test it, I think only one of us should be on it. Good idea, Harold said. And, I said, I think it would be best if you stand right in the center of the raft so you don't fall overboard when I shove it out into the current. I bet it might not even hold one person, Harold said, and I'm wearing my good pants. You go. Harold may not have been a great naval architect, but he wasn't dumb. Why hadn't I thought to wear my good pair of pants? There was nothing to do but make the test float myself. Gingerly, I climbed aboard, making a mental note that the raft bobbed about a good deal and that the posts seemed to be spreading apart under my weight. These were not good signs, particularly since the raft was not yet in the water. Nevertheless, I decided to have a short float. Harold and I first tried christening the raft with a bottle of orange pop, but the bottle refused to break. Since there was every indication we might pound the raft apart before it did so, we drank the pop instead. Then I hopped aboard. Harold pushed the raft out into mid-current, and I was on my way. From that moment on, Harold did not refer to his pants as his good pants. He called them his lucky pants. "How far are you going?" Harold shouted. "Not far," I yelled back. "Just a mile or two." I must say that I have enjoyed few things in my life as much as I did the first 10 seconds of my ride on that raft. Then I perceived that the fence posts were sinking under my feet. Not sinking fast, mind you, but rapidly enough to hold my interest. By the time I rounded the first bend, the raft was completely beneath the surface and the water was lapping at my ankles. Fortunately, the raft stabilized at that point, and I continued drifting precariously along, my attention more or less equally divided between retaining some degree of dignity and looking for the first opportunity to disembark. The spectacle of my apparently standing on the surface of Sand Creek was not without its rewards. It stimulated a herd of milk cows to race wildly along in their pasture in amusing fashion, sent several dogs slinking for home with their tails between their legs, and brought the Petersons' hired hand to his knees, whether out of laughter, shock, or just reverence, I never found out. Gossips later reported to my mother that I had been seen walking on water, and from observations of the final stage of my journey, floating down Sand Creek with a bundle of fence posts under each arm. Old Mom was furious. She told the gossips I got into enough trouble without folks making up lies about me. Over the years, I built up a couple dozen rafts, all of them vastly superior to that initial effort. My first rafting experience, however, taught me numerous lessons about naval architecture, the most important of which is when the time comes for the test float, to make sure that you are the only one of the crew wearing his good pants. In fact, I have noticed that even when a cost-plus aircraft carrier is launched, the people responsible for it are standing around in their best clothes money can buy. And the reason is they started out their careers building fence post rafts. Eventually, I grew up, a fact that surprised many of our neighbors, some of whom lost good money betting against that likelihood. One of the problems of being a grown-up was that I no longer had the time to build log rafts. It occurred to me one day that the next best thing would be a rubber raft. My search for a raft led me ultimately back to my hometown and to an establishment I had frequented much as a kid, Grogan's War Surplus. When I emerged from the tunnel of jerry cans, ammo boxes, and landing nets that formed the entrance to the store, Henry P. Grogan, the proprietor, was hunched over a counter, pasting little paper swastikas on some battered GI mess kits. I was glad to see he hadn't changed over the years, and was reminded of the long-standing business arrangement we had worked out between ourselves when I had frequented his store as a kid. Grogan would try to sell me every worthless, rotten, rusty piece of junk he couldn't peddle to anyone else. I would buy it. The arrangement seemed equitable enough at the time, and both of us were satisfied with it. Now, of course, I was no longer a kid still wet behind the ears. I chuckled to myself at the thought the old codger might even try to pull a fast one on me. When he saw his former associate, Grogan's face erupted into a snaggletooth grin. He swooped down upon me like a chicken hawk on a Rhode Island red. "How's business, Mr. Grogan?" I asked after he extracted from me the history of my life since leaving home. "Not so good," he said, shaking his head. "It dropped off sharply about the time you went to college. Which reminds me, I'm running a special on some fine parachute harnesses if you're interested." "Afraid not," I said. "How about a genuine antique Nazi mess kit, then? Just happened to come across one in the cellar." "No," I said, "I still have a dozen left over from the old days. What I'm looking for is a surplus 7-man rubber life raft." Grogan's face clouded over. "Hell, boy, I hadn't had one of them in a couple of years." "What?" I shouted in dismay. "You don't have one?" It was as if a door had slammed shut on an era, and I hadn't heard it. Never in my life had I gone to Grogan with money in my pocket that he didn't have what I wanted. I don't rightly know where you could find one of them rafts anymore, Grogan said, scratching his head as though he too was confused by it all. Maybe you could find a brand new raft in one of those sporting goods stores. No, I said, I've priced them and they're too expensive. All I've managed to save up for a raft is $50. Well, it sure has been good talking to you about them anyway, Mr. Grogan. Grogan said as if about to sneeze. Hold on there a minute, son. Let me ponder this a spell. Then his face split into that old grin that once had shone down regularly upon my head like the sun at high noon. He scurried out a back door and shortly returned, dragging behind him a greasy, yellow, amorphous mass. What's that? I asked. Grogan wiped his hands on his shirt. This, my boy, is a genuine seven-man war surplus rubber life raft. I'd forgot. I spread it out over some old Jeep transmissions in the backyard a while back to weather a bit. Rubber life rafts like lots of sun and water, you know. Don't know what suddenly made me remember it. That doesn't look to me like it would hold seven men, I said. The way the War Department figured these things, Grogan said, was two men in the raft rowing and five men in the water holding on for dear life. That's why they called it a life raft. Well, I was absolutely delighted. How much? $50. I was so elated at having found a raft that I had it home and half inflated before it occurred to me to feel behind my ears. Sure enough, definite signs of moisture. What Grogan had sold me was not your ordinary seven-man rubber life raft, no. Although I couldn't be certain, I was reasonably sure this was the very same raft that I'd seen on one of those World War II movie sets in the South Pacific. It was the one where the bomber crew has had to ditch in the ocean and the pilot suddenly yells, "Dang it all to heck, men! The last burst from that Zero riddled our life raft!" I yelled too, all the time I was patching up the raft, a task just slightly more complicated than performing abdominal surgery on a hippopotamus. My yells, however, registered a good deal higher than the pilot's on the scale of profanity and called into question the ancestry of the raft, the War Department, the Zero, and last but not least, Henry P. Grogan. By the time the raft was finally repaired, it looked like some creature from the lower depths that had died of yellow jaundice, bloated and popped to the surface where it had advanced into one of the latter stages of decay. Like my first raft, it was not an attractive vessel. My friend Wretch and I would inflate the raft at home with a blower on my wife's vacuum cleaner and then tie it to the top of Wretch's small foreign car to haul it to a river. Once we were stopped by two highway patrolmen. One of them said he had thought the reason Wretch was exceeding the speed limit in a restricted zone was that we were trying to get away from a giant slug that had grabbed our car. I must say, it gives the police a bad image when two officers giggle hysterically while one of them is writing you out a ticket. The raft rekindled in me my old addiction for floating down creeks and rivers. Every spare minute that we could get away from our jobs, Wretch and I were either floating down a river or poring over maps to find a good river to float down. We had floated streams just deep enough to be called damp. On the other extreme, we had floated the Snake and Columbia, both of which had stretches of water that could make a man drunk with fear just looking at photographs of them. Wretch and I shot rapids that made our hair stand on end so hard the follicles turned inside out. Sometimes we had to bail the cold sweat out of the raft to keep from swamping, and we called it a whole lot of fun. Man, we would say to each other, that was fun. As we grew older, sometimes on the raft, we could age a couple of years in just 5 seconds. We began to prefer relaxing floats down gentle rivers, maybe catching a few fish or spending a couple of days hunting in a remote area. Once in a while, we would be surprised to find ourselves bouncing along over what we called interesting water. But for the most parts, these floats were without excitement. One hunting season, Wretch and I were going over our maps when we found this river that had wound through a 30-mile stretch of uninhabited country. It looked just like the place for a combined float and deer hunting trip. On the map, the river appeared calm enough, but we decided to ask around to see if we could find someone who had floated it. We talked to several people who said they'd been down the river, and they told us about the only thing we had to worry about was that the river would be deep enough to float the raft. But watch out for the narrows, they all said, almost as an afterthought. Then they would describe the horrors of the narrows, how the river squeezed between these two rock walls, at the same time dropping over a series of waterfalls, making several right-angle turns, boiling over rocks the size of houses standing on end, and, "Enough," we said, "just tell us where the narrows are located." No one seemed exactly sure about their location. "You can't miss them, though," one fellow said. "You'll know them when you see them." That was what threw us off. On the first day of the float, Rhett and I left our car at the lower end of the river and hired a local rancher to haul us, Rhett's dog, Smart, and our raft and gear up to the jumping-off place. You would have thought the rancher had never been confined in a pickup with two madmen before. He was so nervous. "What for you fellows want to float that donut down the river?" he asked. "Want to do some deer hunting," I said. "Hell," he said, "you could hunt deer on my ranch. Be glad to get rid of a couple of them. Critters are eating me right into the poorhouse." "Nah," Rhett said. "Hunting that way is too easy. We like to make it as hard as possible." The rancher didn't say much after that, no doubt fearing for his life. Anyone crazy enough to float a donut down a river just to make deer hunting hard might grab you by the throat if you happen to say the wrong thing. After we had unloaded at the bank of the river, he rolled his window down just enough so that a madman couldn't lunge through the window and grab a person by the throat. "Watch out for the narrows," he yelled, and then tore off up the road. Our first day on the river was pleasant enough, almost without incident. Then toward evening, Smart, who had been asleep on the pile of rubberized duffel bags, leapt to his feet and sounded a warning. Shortly, we could hear the ominous roar of water off in the distance. "The narrows," I said. "We'd better go ashore and have a look at them." Well, we had to laugh at the way folks tend to exaggerate. The river did squeeze into a narrow channel between these two big rocks, all right, then tumbled down a stair-step fall and finally broke into a rather modest rapid. "Har, har, har," we laughed. "So that's the infamous narrows? Har, har, har." The only water we took in the raft was tears from laughing so hard. "Imagine," Rhett said, wiping his eyes, "grown men chickening out from shooting the narrows. I hereby name them the Chicken Out Narrows," I yelled, waving my paddle over the river like a scepter. "The Chicken Out Narrows." From then on, we relaxed and just enjoyed ourselves. Our former anxiety over the Chicken Out Narrows now merely a source of amusement. We laughed every time one of us mentioned them. Har, har, har! We spent the next day hunting without success. We started out the idea of shooting a couple of trophy bucks and finally settled for the possibility of bagging a couple of hamburgers at a drive-in on our way home. When we staggered exhausted into camp that evening, Rhett said, "Hey, what say we throw our gear on the raft and float out of here tonight? After all, we don't have to worry about the Chicken Out Narrows anymore." "Har, har, har!" "Good idea," I said. "Har, har, har!" As the raft bobbed gently along the moonlit river, we could take turns dozing. Sometimes we would forget who was supposed to be dozing and we would both doze. On one of these occasions, I awoke with a start and noticed that the momentum of the river had picked up considerably. Also, the river was deeper. The reason the river was deeper was that it was flowing through a channel between two sheer rock walls, and the channel was getting, I hate to think of the word, narrow. "Hey, the river's getting narrowed," I yelled. "Har!" Rhett said, popping up into the raft. Smart whimpered. His hair stood out like the quills of a porcupine under attack. Up ahead, the rock walls came together to form a narrow black crack. Occasionally, a big glob of foam would spout up into the creek, crack, sparkle for a moment in the moonlight, then drop back into the darkness. Rhett and the dog and I shouted directions to each other, but all we could hear was the sound of thunder emanating from the black crack. The three of us turned the river into a froth, trying to paddle back upstream, and then the current sucked us into the narrows. I will not attempt to tell what shooting the Narrows in the middle of the night was like, about the paddles snapping in our hands like matchsticks, about the river wrapping the raft around us like dough around three frightened wieners, the drop-offs, the drop-ups, the part where we were walking horizontally along the wall carrying the raft, the part where the raft was on top of us and the river was on top of the raft, and certainly not about the parts where it got bad. It will suffice to say that when we finally emerged from the Narrows, I was paddling with a bolt-action 30-06, Ratch was paddling with the dog, and there was no sign to be found of the raft. Only in recent years has some of the old yearning for rafting returned, and I have no trouble fighting it off. Rhett doesn't care much for rafting anymore either, but he has at last reached the point where he can joke about the chicken out Narrows. He lets on as if he still can't stand the sound of rushing water. If someone turns on a faucet too near him, he pretends to go all white in the face and starts shouting, "Watch out for the Narrows! Watch out for the Narrows!" Oh my. Wes, I hope you enjoyed that one. Well, until the next one, and again, if you guys think I'm huffing on the crack pipe too long, then let me know. south@stalkerstickbows.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. Too many years have passed me by.